Cabu at the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. This month, on Thursday, April 14th at 7 p.m., Cabu at the Clinton will show Who Are My People? Who Are My People is a documentary film which follows four Native American elders as they seek to preserve cultural resources, including large geoglyphs, from the building of renewable energy facilities in California's Mojave Desert. Director Robert Lundahl will be in attendance. Again, that's Who Are My People? Thursday, April 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor The Amish Project, a play running from April 8th through April 24th at the Portland Actors Conservatory.
The Amish Project explores the human effects of tragedy and the profound forgiveness of the Amish after a lone man shot 10 Amish children, ages 6 to 13, in their schoolhouse.
Again, that's The Amish Project, a play by Jessica Dickey and directed by Beth Harper at the Portland Actors Conservatory, 1436 Southwest Montgomery Street in Portland.
More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's 9:01 a.m. Coming up, Edward Snowden and Glenn Greenwald speaking on privacy and surveillance. Followed at 9:30 with whistleblower Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson speaking on Israel's influence and whether that could be good or bad for America. At 10 is Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. Followed at 10:15 with Flashpoints featuring a broadcast live yesterday from a Sustainable Enterprise conference. And at 11 on Digital Divide, host Rabia Yeaman speaks with Walker McMurdo, social media and PR representative for TechFest Northwest, about their upcoming conference and PitchFest. And again, thank all the members of the KBOO Foundation for all of your generous support. Those who are not currently members can remedy that oversight at kboo.fm. You click where it says Donate Today. Messier Snowden and Greenwald, take it away.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Edward Snowden and Glenn Greenwald on Privacy and Surveillance. Excerpt from the March 25, 2016 event at the University of Arizona. Tickets for the cavernous Centennial Hall had sold out days ahead of the conversation on privacy. But the two-hour video was streamed live and is available online. Edward Snowden, Glenn Greenwald, and Noam Chomsky explore the urgent topic of privacy in today's surveillance state. NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden was participating by video stream from Russia. The excerpts you're about to hear focus on him and Greenwald. Glenn Greenwald, of course, is best known as having met with Snowden on his way into exile in Hong Kong in 2013. Greenwald received the documents that Snowden had taken in order to prove the extraordinary depth of government spying that he had observed while employed by the CIA and as contractor for the NSA. Greenwald then was a columnist for the British Guardian and is now founding editor of The Intercept and a frequent guest on CNN, MSNBC, and Democracy Now. Here's a thought-provoking and thoughtful exchange on the resurgence of a free speech movement, constitutional rights in the age of surveillance, the right and even responsibility to alert the public about wrongdoing, the expansion of powers and privileges the government is claiming, and the point of view that rights to privacy exist to protect the minority against the majority. The moderator was Nuala O'Connor, president and CEO of the Center for Democracy and Technology. She asked Greenwald to define his work as journalist.
You are an important actor in this narrative. You've been described as an activist, a journalist, maybe a hack. How do you describe yourself?
You know, ultimately, I don't really see journalism as being this kind of cloistered profession of people who are called journalists and who exclusively possess the right to engage to exercise the right of a free press. I look at my duties first and foremost as a citizen, just like every other citizen. And among the tools available to me, guaranteed by the Constitution, is a free press. And originally, that was intended to be used by every citizen as a means not to gain employment or to earn a livelihood, but to answer the critical question that was supposed to face the United States at its founding, which is, if we create this centralized government and vest it with all of these extreme powers, how do we prevent it from replicating this tyrannical force that the colonists had just liberated themselves from as a result of this really risky war? And the answer was supposed to be, there were going to be all these mechanisms that were designed to check the wielding of the factions that possessed the greatest power. And one of the most critical checks was supposed to be a free press, the ability to stand up to people who wield power and to say, you're making these claims, and rather than mindlessly ingest them or repeat them, I'm actually going to challenge them and I'm going to investigate them. Rather than letting you operate in the dark, I'm going to shine a light on what it is that you're doing so that the citizenry is aware of the things that you're doing with the power that we have given to you. And so whether you call that activism or whether you call that journalism or whether you call it treason or whatever else you might want to describe it as, you know, to me, much more important than the label is the substance of that function. And to me, the core of that function, at least as I try and embrace it and try and practice it, is to make certain that the people who wield the greatest political and economic power are incapable of doing that with no restraints, but instead constantly meet all sorts of critical scrutiny and impediments and attempts to push back against it. And I think everything that we've done in this matter and in everything else I try and do in my journalism is about trying to make things a lot more difficult for those who wield the greatest power.
Edward Snowden. Ed, you've been called by some a traitor and some a patriot. How do you see yourself, and what is your role in today's debate? And why were you the one chosen to play it?
I said before that whistleblowers are sort of elected by circumstance. The idea here is that we are a government that derives its legitimacy from the consent of the governed. But that consent is only meaningful if it's informed. Now, we're supposed to have a system of checks and balances to ensure that that is always the case. We know what's going on. We have the ability to cast our votes to direct the activities of our government. We have an executive that should be checked by the courts that should be directed by the Congress. And this sort of virtuous cycle is supposed to be founded on the idea of competition between them. However, things have changed increasingly over the existence of our nation from when we were first founded, and we were very allergic to the idea of a strong central power, to the very recent past, where we have a government that seems to be almost completely unrestrained by law or the Constitution. And we've had former government officials say things like, we do what's illegal immediately, the unconstitutional takes a little bit longer. But the idea here is that a nation is comprised of people, as is a community, as is a government, as is every structure in which we cooperate with one another. And we all have not just a right, but a responsibility to alert those around us, the other members of our society, of wrongdoing when and where we see it. Now, there were no whistleblower protection laws that applied to intelligence agency contractors like myself in my position. And as I gained seniority, as I gained awareness of what the government was doing, as I gained sort of higher and higher clearances and access to more classified information, I saw that the public declarations of government officials were very different from the actual reality of what was happening. In fact, we were operating beyond the law in a way that many argued was unconstitutional. And the courts have since confirmed that, declaring these programs likely unconstitutional and even calling them Orwellian in their scope. And it's important to understand, how did we get here? How did we reach a point where the individual is all that society can rely upon? Because, of course, we don't want the individual citizen, the individual conscience, to be the last safeguard. Now, giving false testimony to Congress is a felony in our country. And just a few months before the NSA activities showing that they had indiscriminately intercepted the communications of every American, as well as everyone else around the world, when we were seeing videotaped sworn testimony by federal officials, it looked a lot like this.
Does the NSA collect any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans?
No, sir. Not wittingly. There are cases where they could inadvertently, perhaps, collect, but not wittingly.
This clip from Edward Snowden shows Senator Ron Wyden questioning James Clapper, Director of National Intelligence.
Now, in his defense, after that became quite publicly known to be false, he first said he was being too cute by half. And then when he realized that was a felony, he quickly amended that to saying he forgot about the program that was monitoring everyone in the country. Now, reasonable people can disagree about where we should draw the lines of surveillance policy. No one argues that we should shut down every surveillance program in the country. No one says we should list the names of everyone who's under surveillance on the newspaper. But if we are to have a democracy, if we are to be partner to government rather than subject to it, we must know at least the broad powers and privileges that the government is claiming. We must know both what they are doing in our name and what they're doing against us, or else we're no longer directed by the public. We're ruled from above.
Glenn, it's a penumbral right. So how are we doing?
You know, no, I do think actually, you know, when you talk about privacy, the starting point is the fact that it is actually protected in the U.S. Constitution, albeit not with the word privacy. If you look at probably the amendment to the Bill of Rights, which received the greatest attention, it was the idea that the government had no power of general warrants, meaning what the king used to do is order entire villages or neighborhoods or cities subjected to house-by-house searches, that instead you had to have this particular suspicion, reasonable cause, in fact, probable cause, that the person was engaged in some sort of wrongdoing before the state had the right to inspect their papers or persons. That is, in essence, the crux of the definition of privacy. And in so many ways, the debates we're having now were settled over 200 years ago when the government said, we don't have mass surveillance in this country. It's a violation of fundamental rights. The only kind of surveillance that is permitted is when the burden that's on the government is met by them going into a court and saying this particular individual has engaged likely, in all likelihood, in some sort of wrongdoing, and therefore we can invade their home, read their papers, and the like. But I want to just take a step back, because I think the question of what is privacy is a really critical question to ask. And the reason is because a lot of times people treat it as though it's this kind of abstraction. Like, we understand why physical needs, like the need for food or shelter or healthcare, are things that are these immediate, urgent needs that are fundamental to who we are. But a lot of people are really willing to be dismissive about the right to privacy, to treat it as this kind of distant, remote value that even for those of us who sort of think it's a good thing, we're not really willing to say that it's something we demand be protected. And I'm sure all of you in this room have heard the rationale that's used by people who want to belittle the right to privacy, and I bet you a lot of you even think it yourselves, which is the idea that, well, you know what? I'm not one of the bad people. I'm not planning any terrorist attacks. I'm not engaged in violent crimes, and therefore, I don't actually have anything to hide. And what's really fascinating about that I found over the last few years is that even the people who say that, the people who say they don't actually value their privacy, they don't actually mean it at all. And the proof of it is they do all sorts of things to safeguard their own privacy. I mean, we all have things to hide. There are things that everyone in this room would be willing to have their spouse or their best friend or their physician or their lawyer or their psychiatrist know, but would be mortified to have anybody else know. And the people who say they don't value privacy, they do things like they put and use locks on their bedroom and bathroom door. They put passwords on their email and their social media account. They do all sorts of things to ensure there's a place they can go in the world to think and reason and explore without the judgmental eyes of other people being cast upon them. This is really critical to human freedom. We really understand instinctively, without this abstract debate, why privacy is so critical. We are social animals. We have a need for other people to know and see what we're doing, which is why we post things about ourselves online. But we also have the need to be able to do things without other people watching, because when other people are watching what you're doing, you're much more likely to engage in decision-making that's the byproduct of societal orthodoxies or external expectations and not a byproduct of your own agency and independence. And so when we lose privacy, when we allow ourselves to live in a society where we're susceptible to being monitored at all times, we lose a really critical part of what it means to be a free and fulfilled individual. And as Professor Chomsky was saying, we should not allow that to happen in any circumstance except when the government demonstrates there's a really compelling need.
Ed Snowden, you have perhaps arguably given up some of your own privacy in order that many of us have more, one would hope, in the future. What are your thoughts on that?
There are a couple things that I want to pursue on that. Drawing on the arguments made by a former Supreme Court Justice, Brandeis, who offered that privacy is really something different and altogether more valuable than what we expect in the common usage. When we talk about privacy today in the modern context, we're really asking the word to do too much work. Privacy means many different things to many different people. Privacy for many people is just settings on their Facebook page. And so they go, I don't really care. It's just Facebook. But privacy is so much more. Brandeis said privacy is the right to enjoy the products of our own intellect. I would go further. I would say privacy is the fountainhead of all other rights. Privacy is the right to the self. Privacy is the right, as we have in the Constitution, to freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of religion, freedom from unreasonable search and seizure without probable cause. Privacy is the right to a free mind. Now, how can I say that, right? That seems sort of abstract, but when you think about it, privacy is what allows us to determine what we believe without being influenced by others, without being subject to peer pressure, without our ideas being prejudged before they're fully formed. Freedom of speech has no meaning if you don't have the space, the time, the freedom to determine what it is that you want to say. Freedom of religion has no value if you cannot independently determine what it is that you believe in. Otherwise, you're being influenced by what's popular or what you inherited. Now, when we go further from this, we realize that this is actually inherently understood by generations of speakers, generations of thinkers, going down all the way, which are the underpinnings of our language. It's called private property for a reason. Without privacy, you can't have anything for yourself. You exist as a collective. You exist in a state of reaction to your environment at all times. You are a part of a larger being, but at no time are you permitted to have a space that is only just for you. And when I sort of follow this, and I think about this in my own terms, particularly when we're confronted with the arguments of sort of apologists for the national security state, and the argument that was first proposed by the Nazis against privacy, which was if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear. I would say that arguing that you don't care about privacy because you have nothing to hide is like saying that you don't care about free speech because you have nothing to say. Rights exist and have value for more than just the individual in the current moment. Rights are both individual and collective. And when we think about the value of a free press, we're not all journalists, but we still derive value from them. Moreover, rights are not really intended. Rights are not really designed for use by the elites, the people who are leading our debates, because these are the people who are least threatened with the abrogation of their rights. The system exists to serve and protect these people. Rights are almost always needed on a regular, continuing basis by those who are vulnerable, by those who are not protected by the system, by those who are not protected by their communities, by the people who are different, by the people who are ahead of everyone else, who are proposing a new idea, or people who are simply minorities, don't have access to the same resources, don't have access to the same ability to compete. And to say fundamentally that you don't care about a right, even if it is truly of no value to you, because you're not using it in this current moment and you don't expect to use it in the future, is probably the most antisocial thing I can imagine.
Question from our Two Shoes app. You all clearly care about privacy, and these gentlemen are contributing incredible amounts to this debate and the thought leadership. But do people in general care? Do people's activities online and being willing to give so much information freely show that people are less concerned about their digital selves than perhaps we all might want them to be? Let's start with Ed again.
So I'll try to take this quickly because since I just rambled for some time here, I would argue it depends on the individual because ultimately privacy, your feelings, your beliefs are always individual in nature. You can try to extrapolate from this. You can try to do some polling based on the groups. But to say that it doesn't have value even to the majority isn't really that material, even if it is the case. Again, rights don't exist for the majority. Rights exist to protect the minority against the majority. But even in this context, right, even if we put that aside, I would argue that many people do care about privacy, and they're beginning to care about it more than they have before because they didn't realize it was threatened. They didn't realize they were being watched. As you said previously, we've seen polling that indicates people are getting more protective of their privacy now. They're being more careful. They're concerned about the monitoring that's occurring. And when we think about why this is, generally there's a question here that I would actually be really interested in the ideas of the other speakers on the stage, is that there's this traditional idea that we inherited that some human interactions leave no trace. They occur without records. They are ephemeral in nature. It's an experience shared between you and your spouse, you and your pastor, or as they used to say, sort of in the privacy of your own home, the things that happen within those four walls are between you and your God, if you believe in them. Now, the NSA and other intelligence services around the world thought, well, that's really quite a shame, because imagine if we could hear everything. Imagine if we could hear what was happening within the four walls of your home. There would be tremendous investigative value in this. Now, they're not wrong. And the problem here is not necessarily that surveillance can occur at all. It's that it happens indiscriminately. It's that it happens to all of us all the time. And we're populating sort of buckets with the activities, the records of everyone, because they're out there. They're free. As long as you can access the telecommunications service providers, you can pull them right off the wire, what the government calls metadata, who you call, where you go, the things you've done, the purchases you've engaged with, the diary of activities of your life, with every entry of what you've done, but not necessarily the details of how that you did it. Now, we take that back to this idea that there were private spaces before that no one could intrude upon by virtue of the fact that no records were left behind. If you wanted to know what someone did within their home, you had to ask them, and you had to hope they were willing to cooperate. But what we've seen is the advances of technology have allowed these state security agencies to go, well, why don't we build God from a machine? Why don't we create that form of omniscience through technology and create records on everyone just in case at some point we want to go back and look and see what they did? Now, this is a fairly extraordinary and unprecedented thing. Now, it is possible that the majority of the population would argue that this is a good thing, that we want our governments to be powerful, to be capable, to be omniscient, because then they could thwart additional crimes. But if that is to occur, at the very least, this is a decision that I believe the public should be involved in. We have a right to know, and we have a right to discuss it. This is not a decision that can ever be made for us by a few officials behind closed doors. And unfortunately, that is increasingly what we see happening.
No, I could just address that. You know, on the question of whether people care about privacy, I remember really vividly when Ed and I were in Hong Kong before we started reporting these stories, we spent a lot of time talking about what the likely outcome of the reporting would be. And we really had no idea what it would be. And I remember, because it struck me so much, Ed at one point saying, you know, I don't have any fears about what's about to happen in terms of what gets done to me, about going to prison. And it was clear that he meant that. And he said, the only fear that I really have is that we do this reporting and we unveil this to the world and people just sort of shrug and say, well, I assume the government was doing that, or I don't really care that they were doing that. And that it would be a 1 or 2 day story and then people would forget about it and go about their lives. And of course, that's exactly what did not happen. It became this enormous, incredibly consuming worldwide story, not just in the United States, but in dozens of countries on multiple continents around the world, precisely because people were so angry and offended at the intrusion into their privacy, including people who might have said in the past, I don't really care. And there's all kinds of evidence that shows just how concerned they are, from the massive increase in the number of people around the world who are now using encryption to protect the privacy of their communications, to the number of people who put pressure on the US government and both parties to enact legislation limiting these programs. But maybe the best evidence of all about how much people care about privacy is the behavioral change in Silicon Valley companies, the biggest ones, Yahoo and Facebook and Apple and Google and Microsoft. When I first read the archive that Ed gave me, one of the things that struck me the most was what full-scale collaborators these companies were in the surveillance state that the NSA had created. They were not only complying, there's a helpful chart from Ed that has just magically popped up, all the companies that were part of the prison program and when they joined. And it includes essentially every leading company in Silicon Valley. And they not only cooperated to the extent the law required, but even way beyond that. There were documents about how Microsoft would meet with the NSA to help them build backdoors into Skype at the same time that they were promising the public that Skype was impenetrable. And the reason they were such full-scale collaborators is because they were doing it completely in the dark and no one knew they were doing it, and therefore there was no cost. Once we were able to shine a light on what these companies were doing and the full-scale partnership they had created with the government, all of that changed completely. And it didn't change because these companies decided suddenly that they care about your privacy. They still don't care about your privacy. But what changed is their fear that they would lose the current generation or the next generation of internet users to social media companies in Korea or Brazil or Germany who would be able to say, don't give your data to Facebook and Apple because they'll give it to the NSA. Give it to us instead. And they knew that it was really imperative that they demonstrate to the public that they actually are willing to safeguard people's privacy, even if it means standing up to the FBI, refusing, even in a case like San Bernardino, to build a backdoor into iPhones, even if it meant enduring being called aiders and abettors of ISIS or having blood on their hands as a result of helping terrorists hide their communication. All the things these companies have endured and are enduring, not because they're suddenly privacy activists, but because they know that tens of millions of people around the world care deeply about their privacy and won't use these companies if they think their privacy is going to be compromised. That is the best evidence of all to answer the question, do people care about their privacy?
That was journalist and author Glenn Greenwald, who was the first to see the trove of documents revealing U.S. government surveillance that former NSA contractor Edward Snowden took with him on his journey into exile. This was an excerpt of a meeting on privacy held on March 25, 2016 at the University of Arizona. Snowden participated by video link from Russia. The full two-hour film of the event called Conversation on Privacy, that also includes MIT Professor Emeritus Noam Chomsky, is on YouTube at the websites of The Intercept, Common Dreams, Truthdig, and many more. Links can be found on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Mariah Gilardin.
And that was Edward Snowden and Glenn Greenwald speaking on privacy and surveillance. Coming up next, whistleblower Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson speaks on Israel's influence, good or bad for America. This is on your community radio, KBOO Portland. Stay tuned.
TUC Radio, time of useful consciousness. Israel's influence, good or bad for America. Against the background of an increasingly more urgent debate over the sources of conflict in the Middle East, the growth of ISIS, the refugee crisis, and the role of the U.S. armed interventions in Iraq, Libya, and Syria, this question takes on great importance. Who is setting Middle East policy in the U.S.? Who decides whether to go to war? And who receives weapons and financial aid? And who gets bombed? These and other topics were addressed at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. on March 18, 2016, at the Conference on Israel's Influence, Good or Bad for America. And you will hear from one of their speakers in a moment. Retired Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson is the highest-ranking U.S. foreign policy whistleblower to date. He was Secretary of State Colin Powell's chief of staff from 2002 to 2005. As early as 2007, Wilkerson stated in a Dutch documentary that APAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, was highly influential in the Bush administration's decision to go to war in Iraq. APAC is a lobbying group that advocates pro-Israel policy to the Congress and executive branch of the United States. It has been called the most important organization affecting America's relationship with Israel and one of the most powerful lobbying groups in the U.S. Unlike lobbies for all other foreign countries, it is not required to register with the Justice Department as a foreign agent. When Lawrence Wilkerson spoke in March 2016, the annual APAC conference was just 2 days away. After hearing from Vice President Joe Biden on its opening night, those watching C-SPAN the following day would be treated to an extraordinary feature in the U.S. presidential races, when all candidates for president, with the exception of Bernie Sanders, appeared as special guests at the APAC conference. All of them, regardless of party affiliation, pledged their loyalty and promised money and whatever weapons Israel might require to maintain its qualitative military edge over all the other countries in the region. And they promised to come to its defense should it be attacked. While both Donald Trump and Ted Cruz said that they would tear up the deal negotiated with Iran among their first acts in office, Hillary Clinton stressed that she would impose real consequences on Iran for even the smallest violation of this agreement, end quote. the Institute for Research, Middle East and Policy, and the American Educational Trust, publisher of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, held annual conferences at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. since 2014. The 2016 conference, Israel's Influence, Good or Bad for America, was held on Friday, March 18. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson spoke on Israel's influence on U.S. foreign policy. Whistleblowers in this time and age are rare enough, and to become one is increasingly risky. But coming from the military, such as Wilkerson, who was Colin Powell's chief of staff from 2002 to 2005, is doubly significant. Wilkerson is working on a book about the first George W. Bush administration. He currently is Distinguished Visiting Professor of Government and Public Policy at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia. He is Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, recorded in March 2016. He's addressing Israel's influence on U.S. foreign policy.
Ever since 1948, Israel has been a foreign and security policy problem. That Israel was a problem, a rather large one as a matter of fact, in 47 and 48 even, was most recently pointed out to me by one of my truly brilliant students. In fact, in a decade of teaching at both the George Washington University's Honors Program and William & Mary, and 6 years at two of the nation's war colleges, I've rarely had better papers than the one he submitted at the end of our semester on fateful decision-making. Now, fateful decision-making is what I teach in this seminar, and as the ancient Greeks said, it's when old men send young men, and now women, to die for state purposes, and something we often forget, to kill others for state purposes. He shall go unnamed, this student paper writer, but not unheralded by me at least. I will say, too, that he had the additional characteristic, if you will, of being a Jewish American, which recalls to mind for me immediately a most unnerving moment as I had just begun my new career in 2001 as an erstwhile diplomat. I just entered the inner sanctum of a man who would prove to be very powerful at state over the next 4 years. He had only recently discovered that I had chosen to work for Richard Haass in his capacity as director of policy planning rather than staying directly under my old mentor, the new Secretary of State, Colin Powell. "Why," he asked, "did you elect to work for that self-loathing Jew?" Recovering from mild shock, I looked him straight in the eye and replied, "I'll forget I heard that." I turned and evacuated his inner sanctum while he harumphed to my rear. I recall this little anecdote because it reveals what many use as a riposting device against any Jewish American who, through critical thinking, questions from time to time the policies of the modern state of Israel and the U.S. relationship with that state. Its complement, of course, for Gentiles like me, is anti-Semite. I've no doubt were someone such as Alan Dershowitz, from whom I have heard, for example, to read my student's paper, the response, "self-loathing Jew," would not be far from his lips. In 1948, I would submit there was no explicit such challenge for Jewish Americans or for any other American for that matter. The ingrained and highly partisan nature of the U.S.-Israel relationship and the neoconservative adoption of it in particular had not yet come about. What my student rehearsed in the opening to his paper were the profound objections of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, of the iconic hero of World War II, after all, Harry Truman, in a moment of apoplexy, essentially said, "He won the war. He won the war." He couldn't think of anything more to say about this man, George Marshall, who was now Secretary of State. And others objected to what Harry Truman was about to do with regard to the state of Israel. My students summed these objections that the Joint Chiefs had penned as the vehement Arab opposition to a Jewish state, The threat such opposition presented to the key oil imports from neighboring Arab countries, and then my student quoted the Joint Chiefs verbatim. Quote, the decision to partition Palestine, if the decision were supported by the United States, would prejudice United States strategic interests in the Near and Middle East to the point that United States influence in the area would be, and here come the words, curtailed to that which could be maintained by military force. Is that prescience or is that prescience? Harry Truman, on the other hand, as my student pointed out, summed up the case for, if you will, thusly. I'm sorry, gentlemen, the president said, but I have to answer to hundreds of thousands who are anxious for the success of Zionism. I do not have hundreds of thousands of Arabs among my constituents. Marshall, in a tale that's not apocryphal, when Truman did decide that he was going to essentially recognize the state that had stood up, Israel, threatened not to vote for the president if he did. Coming from a man like Marshall, who, as a military professional, never voted in his life, this was almost stunning for Truman to hear. Of course, he went ahead, and so we began our relationship. There were, to be sure, more counterarguments than the president's reelection, as my student also pointed out in this excellent paper. The horrors of the Holocaust, the plight of hundreds of thousands of Jewish refugees, and the need to make up for the wrongs committed against the Jewish people all spoke for recognition by Truman. My student continued also, in the Balfour Declaration of 1917, the British had promised the Jewish people a homeland in Palestine. And in the eyes of many Americans after World War II, it was up to the U.S. to give that home to them. And Harry S. Truman did just that. Today, we can look back on a line of post-World War II presidents who tried to deal with the challenges and more that the Joint Chiefs of Staff had so presciently laid out. And to be honest, and as many of you in this audience probably are well aware, the Joint Chiefs were not breaking new ground. Ever since World War I and Louis Brandeis's influence on Woodrow Wilson and his foremost advisor, Edward House, the U.S. State Department's position on the potential for a Jewish state in Palestine had been quite clear. It opposed the Zionist movement because it was a minority group interfering in United States foreign affairs. Again, talk about prescience, and there we have it, prescience par excellence. Even so, could state at that time have envisioned the power of AIPAC today, particularly after Bill Clinton decided in 1995, as I recall, to make presidential appearances there, de rigueur. I love that French phrase. I looked it up in Merriam-Webster to see what English definitions were given to it. The second one was this, quote, necessary if you want to be popular, unquote. Oh, Bill, the things you did for popularity's sake. But despite these heavily adverse conditions, most U.S. presidents manage a rather precarious balance. Whether as in the beginning it was Eisenhower in 56, as we've heard before, telling the Israelis, British, and French to get their invading military forces out of the Suez Canal area, or it was Ronald Reagan in the mid to late 1980s, selling AWACS aircraft to the Saudis, or George H.W. Bush insisting on real and serious work on the Middle East peace process following the first Gulf War in 1991, in which the U.S. had gained quite a bit of new leverage applicable to that process's survival and potential success. And you all know probably, too, there are some critics who've written quite eloquently, in my view, that George H.W. Bush lost the election in 92 because of his vehement opposition to Israeli settlements. And then came George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and a presidency captured by the neoconservatives, of which I was a part. In a flash, Israel became publicly a strategic ally. Its prime minister, Ariel Sharon, in every Arab eye, dripping blood all over the Oval Office carpet, blood from Israel's invasion and occupation of Lebanon in 1982 and 83, and I might add, an invasion we had to haul their ass out of, and ultimately, at the cost of the greatest single-day casualty of Marines since Tarawa in World War II. This man, Ariel Sharon, became, in President Bush's own words, quote, a man of peace, unquote. And all the fears of the 1948 Joint Chiefs of Staff loom so largely in the rearview mirror of history that some of us in the U.S. government sucked in our collective breaths and found it hard to exhale. thereafter. But of course we did, and ever since, people just like us have been trying clearly to little avail, with some brilliant exceptions, of which the Iran nuclear agreement is the most exceptional and recent, to restore that precarious balance maintained since World War II by all other presidents. And so today, where are we in this relationship? So fraught with danger, and as has been pointed out, danger to both parties, to Israel and the United States. Today, how does U.S. policy toward Israel impact our overall foreign and security policy in adverse or positive ways? To start, we have the unguarded words of General David Petraeus to illuminate our inquiries before he was himself subjected to the ritual of head bashing that accompanies such remarks. In a hearing before the Senate Armed Services Committee in March of 2010, Petraeus said quite straightforwardly that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict foments anti-American sentiment in the region due to a perception of U.S. favoritism toward Israel, and it makes military operations that much more difficult. These remarks came amidst a U.S.-Israeli dispute over housing units, 1,600 of them, in Jerusalem, illegal under international law, in defiance of UN Security Council resolutions, and destabilizing to the max. I can tell you that in the military councils, of which I've been part over three decades plus, this sentiment was often voiced, and at times in far more dramatic terms. When my old mentor and boss, Colin Powell, and I used to talk about the issues here, we rarely, if ever, complimented Israel on its additions to U.S. security posture in the region. Quite the opposite, as a matter of fact, although today I suspect he would deny such conversations, and frankly, I wouldn't blame him. It would prove my point. But there is more. There is concrete evidence of Israel's detracting from U.S. security and of its being a strategic liability rather than an asset. Where is, after all, U.S. hard power in Southwest Asia, in Africa, and the Persian Gulf today? First, it ain't in Israel. Nor could it be, unless the world was at war and all bets were off. And I'll come to that scenario in a minute. Under any other conceivable scenario, the U.S. will never land meaningful military forces on the unsinkable Middle East aircraft carrier of Israel. That's a phrase used by some of my neoconservative colleagues. Every instance of the use of force by the U.S. in the region to date has proven that reality beyond the shadow of a doubt. So where exactly is the hard power? It's in Qatar. It's in Bahrain. It's in Saudi Arabia. It's in Kuwait, Oman, Egypt, Djibouti, and a host of other lesser places. The largest U.S. Air Force complex on Earth, for example, by some measures, is in Qatar. The most powerful fleet headquarters in the U.S. arsenal, the fifth, is in Bahrain. The land-based aircraft carrier, if there is one, is Kuwait, not Israel, as both Gulf Wars have proven. As a matter of fact, my comment during the first Gulf War, when we landed over 500,000 U.S. soldiers and all the supplies that went with them, was, my God, another Marine, another soldier will sink Kuwait. In fact, in all my years in the military and beyond, I've never heard a serious suggestion of using Israel to help defend U.S. interests in the region. Instead, what I have heard many times is advice and decision-making to stay totally away from such use. Moreover, each one of those genuine hard power interests that I just enumerated is threatened, as General Petraeus pointed out indirectly, by the U.S. unbalanced role as Israel's lawyer and unquestioning great power supporter. In fact, examining the single strategic scenario in which use of Israel might be a viable option is so grim as to be self-defeating in conception as well as execution, God forbid. Imagine, if you will, a general war in Southwest Asia with Turks fighting Russians, allied with Greeks, Iranians and Hezbollah fighting Saudi proxies, Iraqis plunged into sectarian warfare while the Kurds tried desperately to survive, ISIS spread from Kabul through Aleppo to Tripoli and perhaps beyond, and the U.S. deciding to do more than provide special operating forces and air power. Imagine, in other words, the beginnings of a region-wide and then possibly global conflict. Imagine, too, the only ally the U.S. will have in this is Israel, and Israel about to be overwhelmed itself in all likelihood. People will be choosing sides. Jordan and Egypt will choose sides, as will 350 to 400 million others. So the U.S. lands major military forces on the unsinkable aircraft carrier Israel. This is, of course, after we mobilize fully, conscript at a minimum 2 million men and women, spend a year training them, and then enter the fray. Inconceivable? I hope so. Another major and overwhelming negative influence that I saw up close and personal, besides these hard power facts, was every time Rich Armitage, the Deputy Secretary of State at the time, took us to the budget drill. It's been highlighted here earlier, but I want to highlight it for you in even more graphic terms. We would go into the room with all the assistant secretaries, undersecretaries, office heads, directors, and so forth assembled to battle the budget. And mind you, it's really kind of an anemic battle because the Defense Department was getting around $600 billion and we were getting around $30 billion. Donald Rumsfeld said he lost more money in a year than we got. He was right. But we would go in there and we would look at the money for U.S. foreign affairs. Yes, U.S. foreign affairs. We would take out immediately $3-plus billion for Israel and $3-plus billion for Egypt to bribe them to keep the peace treaty with Israel. And then we would look at the rest. We'd then factor out international military education and training and those other things that are just more or less fixed, and we'd say, wow, we got less than $1 billion left for the entire foreign policy of the United States of America. Now, do you understand a little bit why diplomacy is not really an instrument we reach for very often? And I'll not refrain either from pointing out possibly more insidious factors that demonstrate to me rather conclusively that Israel is an untenable ally, or that when Israel, you've got Israeli arms merchants often selling arms to our most likely enemies, UAVs to Russia here lately when UAVs were a problem for Russia, and they're no longer a problem, or that when Israel breaks U.S. law and does things that we don't do anything but demarsh them from. These are other aspects of our relationship that I've been very close to that have been disturbing, but mostly have enlightened me as to what it means to have this ally. Now, let me conclude with a recognition of reality. First, President Obama, as I earlier intimated with the JCPOA, has regained a little ground, but at considerable cost, not least of which is an even more robust military-to-military relationship, intelligence relationship, and has been highlighted here an increase in funding, maybe to $5 billion. If Israel went away tomorrow, if all the previous military and diplomatic advice had been followed, and if we'd not assisted perfidious Albion in setting up an experiment that would result in ethnic cleansing, akin to our own Indian wars, in the heart of Palestine, even if we had not then managed to unbalance majorly our own approach to the precarious dance required to manage such a concoction, even if all had gone swimmingly since 1948 with regard to Israel, the region in question, Southwest Asia, the Middle East, call it what you will, would still be a boiling cauldron of instability, chaos, and wreckage. In short, were there no state of Israel at all, the region would still be in a mess. Or settle the Israeli-Palestinian challenge tomorrow with a decent two-state solution that worked, and the same would adhere. The region would remain in turmoil. But the United States would not be painted with the broad brush of favoritism and prejudice policy that it is every day, 24/7, impacting its security and foreign policy. Now, it must be acknowledged as well that part of this reality of a volatile region is our fault, too, because we have coddled, supported, funded, advised, and used tyrant after tyrant to fulfill our wishes. Whether it was the Shah of Iran for 26 years, the King in Riyadh, the Emir in Qatar, or whomever, how many dictators have we accommodated or worse? The region's calamities have many causes. A majority religion that has seen no reformation, the Nahalite kicking and screaming into modernity, Tyrants who have sucked its people's blood dry, as I said, a distinct lack of entrepreneurial talent or desire nursed by dependency on black gold. Interestingly, one of the most entrepreneurial people in the region are the Palestinians. A surfeit of strategic waterways and the adjacent land masses begging to be contested. Tribal instincts of the very worst sort, not to mention a legacy of English missteps, misdemeanors, crimes, artificial border drawings, and double dealings that all by themselves would damn any people to purgatory at best and to hell at worst. But that is no reason for the United States of America to so tie its foreign and security policy to a tiny enclave in the midst of chaos that when the enclave goes, the master might be sucked into the morass that results. And for no positive purpose of power whatsoever. Does the unbalanced policy of the U.S. toward this enclave jeopardize U.S. national security interests? You bet it does, big time. All we should ask, all I'm asking, all I asked for 4 years in the State Department, is that the American people be told the unvarnished truth and then decide if they're willing to do it. Do they want their foreign and security policy based on sound principles of power management? Or do they want it based on passions, ideology, and unbridled favoritism? Now, I'm not quite certain what their answer is going to be, but I'm dead certain we need to give them the essential facts and then ask the question. Thank you.
That was Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. Recorded on March 18, 2016. He spoke at the conference, Israel's Influence, Good or Bad for America. Wilkerson was Secretary of State Colin Powell's Chief of Staff during the fateful time of the U.S. war on Iraq. He's the highest-ranking U.S. foreign policy whistleblower to date. The conference where he spoke was organized by the Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy, and the American Educational Trust. CNN recorded the conference, and you can find access to the link via the website of the Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy, www.irmep.org. That's irmep.org. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
This is KBOO Portland.
It's 9:57 a.m. coming up at 10. We're going to fill the hour with Air Cascadia and a rebroadcast of yesterday's Flashpoints, generously shared with us by our siblings in struggle at KPFA in Berkeley, California. The next hour at 11 on The Digital Divide, host Rabia Yemen speaks with Walker McMurdo, the social media and PR representative for TechFest Northwest. Check that out. That's all coming up this morning on your community radio, right after this.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Climate Change Tools for Faith Communities, a workshop led by Tim DeChristopher, Saturday, April 9th, starting at 10 a.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. During this day-long workshop, Sewell Lecture Speaker Tim DeChristopher will share integrated and multi-faith strategies to prevent climate change and environmental injustice, combat poverty, and restore dignity to both people and the planet. Again, that's a Climate Change Tools for Faith Communities, a workshop led by Tim DeChristopher, Saturday, April 9th at 10 a.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio, along with Street Roots Newspaper, is proud to co-sponsor Amy Goodman's Portland appearance Sunday, May 8th, at the Aladdin Theater. She'll be talking about Democracy Now, 20 years covering the movements changing America. Her new book, co-authored by David Goodman and Dennis Moynihan. And Amy will be doing a book signing after the talk. All proceeds go to benefit KBOO and Street Roots Newspaper. Again, that's Amy Goodman on Sunday, May 8th at the Aladdin Theater, 3017 Southeast Milwaukee Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm/democracynowbenefit. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Thank you.